For writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to a fantastic new author. His name is Paco Chiarici. I hope I pronounced that right, and we'll check with him when he gets on the phone. And his book is called Lions of the Sky. He is a fighter pilot, and I just love fighter pilots, so I'm really excited to be talking to him. But before we talk about flying the latest fighter jets in the world, we're going to go back in time to one of my favorite eras, the Tudor. Oh, the Tudor period is, I think it's so fascinating, and I am so thrilled that Mary Lawrence was able to join me today, and she has a series called Bianca Goddard Mysteries. They are fantastic, and today we're going to talk about book four. It's The Alchemist of Lost Souls. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Wow. I love your books.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well,
I have to commend you for reading 10,000 books. I was reading that on your website, and I was amazed.
Well,
that's,
you know,
quite an accomplishment.
It is, and it's so funny. When I started this program 4 years ago, I was just at the point I said, "Well, I have to start clearing out my books. I'm not going to start thinning it out," you know. And then I started this program, and now I get like 8 to 12 books a week.
Oh, my goodness.
It's so funny. But
can you keep up with it?
I read the ones I like, and I invite the authors whose books I enjoy, because it's so much fun for me to talk to authors I won't invite somebody I don't like their books. That's the nice thing about having your own. You know, so many people they review books, but they are, you know, on radio stations where they have to talk to people. I can pick and choose. And so I am particularly
great
in a Tudor mood, because I have been rereading Margaret George's fantastic books.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she is just an amazing author. I was up in Madison, Wisconsin, got to have lunch with her and talk to her. And I have been back in this whole Tudor mode. And I think it is so fascinating. And you do is you take it down a level. She's up there in the court, you know. She's up there with the fancy people, you know.
Yes.
It's Henry VIII, and it's all you know, Elizabeth, and so we're learning the inside of the castle, and here we're learning a lot about the outside, which is so fascinating.
Well, thank you. Yes, I when I got interested in the Tudor period, I read a lot of historical fiction, and I found most of it taking place in the king's court or Elizabeth's court, and that's all great. I mean, it's all wonderful, but I began wondering about the lower classes, the common man. I was thinking, how did they manage to survive Henry VIII's reign, because he was pretty brutal, and you had to watch your back every step. So that's what got me going on all of this, kind of wondering about, you know, commoners.
And
how did they manage it?
And you tell details that really flesh out the period for us, because the Tudor period, which was, for people who don't know, it was from basically 1485 to 1605.
Yes.
And this is such a fascinating period. And most people, I mean, even in school, or if they teach anything in school anymore, I don't know.
Yeah.
But even if you go to, you know, university and you take the top class in British history, they don't talk about the importance of this period. Everything would have been different if Henry VIII had not wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. Our entire world.
It's very true. The 16th century stood on the cusp of the modern era, really. And Henry effectively made himself Pope of his own church. That's what it boils down to.
And he changed history, because if England had remained Catholic, mm-hmm. America would have been such a different place.
Yes, I think you're right.
I mean, it would have been completely, it might not have existed, because everything really comes back to this guy being crazy about Anne Boleyn. You know, he gets rid of the Pope, he starts his own church, it's really, yeah. And this period is so important, and that's why I tell people, you know, it's so wonderful to get yeah. immersed in history, and you have done it.
It is. Wow. It really is. I was a science major in college, so I never got to take the history courses that I wanted to. And when I got a little bit older, I started reading about different periods and things that I wanted to kind of fill in my own knowledge gap. And I fell in love with the Tudor period. I just, it started with reading Shakespeare's plays, and then the more I looked into all of that, I wanted to find out more about what was going on in the politics and leading up to it. And I was very confused about Henry VIII. I really didn't feel like I knew that much about him. So I went back, and I've kind of been reading all kinds of things for over 20 years about that particular time period. And just changing, welcoming in the reformists and tweaking it to his liking. I mean, he was a pretty interesting fellow. He had a lot of diseases going on that he was also dealing with, and so some people speculate that some of that has something to do with some of his petulance and brutality, and probably so. Yeah, it is an interesting period, and I think I had someone ask me, "Well, how did you research commoners, the lower classes?" And really and truly, there aren't that many books out there that talk about commoners, but just about any reference book that I would read about the period, they would make a reference as to what it was like for the commoners. And so I would just kind of stash that away for my own use later on. And so a lot of it is kind of imagining, with the little bits and pieces that I've pieced together, kind of imagining that world. So.
Well, and you've woven it all around Bianca Goddard, who is the daughter mm-hmm. of an alchemist. And yes. In this new book, her husband is being yeah. conscripted into Henry's forces, which most people don't know that actually in England they did not have a standing army. It was really
that's correct.
Unlike that's on right. the on the continent, where all of the, you know, even the Pope had an army and all the mm-hmm. other kings had armies, but in England it was very much a people's army called up whenever what they were
yes.
needed.
Exactly. And at the end of Henry's reign, he was kind of hoping to relive the glory days of his youth, and he wanted to invade France, which he really despised. He did not get along with Francis the First, and so he wanted to go back in again to France. But also he was angry with France for helping the Scots on the border, and so he was torn between these two conflicts. And so in the story, John has to go to a view of arms, where he is asked to show his talents with the bow and arrow, which Henry made a law. Every able-bodied man back then was supposed to practice their archery skills on Sundays. And I think some of them got out of it. Like in the story, I have John kind of blowing it off, not making much of it. But Henry was very much enamored of his archers. And so John doesn't do very well. And so, yeah, he ends up getting conscripted as a billman, which are the fellows that would sort of protect the archers. They had the long bills, the big spears, sort of, so to speak, and they suffered the greatest mortality rate on the field, on the battlefield. So there is John, and he's being conscripted into this army and taken away. For Bianca has no idea where he's really going or for how long he's going to be gone. So, yeah.
Well, from book one, you know, we learn about Bianca and her mm-hmm. love of chemistry. And, you know, and it's funny, you of course, being a cytotechnologist, you did some lab work when you were in training?
Yes.
And I did. I was a lab tech when I was young. So I did a lot.
Oh, terrific.
And I spent many, many hours at a microscope looking at cells. So I know what it feels like. But I was also in that period when before everything was computerized. So you actually worked with test tubes, and you worked with, you know, doing the tests, and you did I don't know if you were there when they were still doing glucose tolerance tests, and it was so exciting. I just loved I loved the lab. It was so much fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, but truthfully, I got kind of bored.
Well, me too. That's why I got out of it.
After a while. Yeah. After a while, you know, I wasn't really interacting with patients. It was just a name on a requisition for me. And so that's kind of what got me going, making up stories about people's names. I would be inspired by a name on a requisition and just kind of play around with it in my head. So, yeah.
Well, so tell us more about Bianca, how you came out with that character, because I think she's really great.
Oh, thank you. Well, originally, the very first book I wrote was a coming-of-age story, and Bianca was the young woman whose father was an alchemist, as in this series. But the book never went anywhere, but I started writing other things. And eventually, after lots of rejections and whatnot, I went back to that original story, and I thought, well, I really like Bianca as a character. Why don't I try a mystery? I've never written a mystery before, so why don't I put her in that kind of situation where she's sort of an unwilling sleuth, and she uses her knowledge of basic chemistry to help her. And so I think she's kind of evolved over the series. I think the first book shows her maybe being a little bit brazen in some of the things that she does. And then as she gets a little older, she becomes a little wiser about what she can and cannot or should not do during that time period. So yeah, she evolves over the period, and she's a person who was an only child. Her father was an alchemist who fell out of favor with the king, and her mother was the neighborhood white witch. And back then, if you didn't have the money to hire a physician, you would go to someone local whom you could barter with for some sort of remedy. So she was well-versed in plants, and she knew a little bit of rudimentary chemistry from her father, from working with him in the laboratory. And also, she did not want to become an alchemist, so to speak, because she saw the folly involved in all of that. She saw her father using the family resources to buy his ingredients and fancy equipment. And she was often left on the streets to try to survive. So she became a very good pickpocket, or cut purse, as they're called back then. And when she got hungry, she went out on the streets and snatched plums and food in order to survive. So she just, and she met John through one of her escapades. She nearly gets caught. And John, another sort of cut purse or waif on the street, sees her and sees her predicament and helps her escape. So that begins her relationship with John, her significant other, as you find out later in the story. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the things when I was reading Margaret George's book, Henry VIII, and she writes several times in there about how one of Henry VIII's favorite, actually his favorite meal was eels. And I don't know if you ever watched the Great British Cook-Off. They recently, one of the challenges was to do an eel pie. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, which is very funny because people, you know, I lived in England for many years, and I must say, I bought a cottage in England, a 400-year-old cottage actually, it was back to the days when there was actually a hiding place in my cottage in the bottom of my cottage, underneath my main floor, place for priests to hide as they were escaping.
Yeah, a priest hole.
Oh, wow. Yeah, 40 feet deep, actually, which was quite a surprise.
Yeah, amazing.
And it cost me a lot of money because I didn't know about it when I bought the house. But the funny thing is, I never did eat eel pie when I was in England, although they do still eat it, which is quite amazing because I love the way you write about the Thames. Tell us a little bit about the Thames.
I guess you have to think of it, you have to try to think of it 500 years ago. And back then the streets in London were pretty muddy and nasty. There were very few paved roads with cobblestone or anything. So people relied on the Thames to get from one end of London to the other. So depending on the tide, they would catch a wherry or hail a boatman to take them up the river or down the river, and then they could, you know, jump off and walk a shorter distance to wherever it was that they had to go. And so that was their, there were all kinds of barges, all kinds of boats on the river, ferrying people up and down the river and across the river to Suffolk, which is where Bianca keeps her room of medicinals and physiques. And Suffolk back then was kind of London's seedy sister city. It was run by the Bishop of Winchester, and he got all the profits for the taxes from businesses over there. So there were tons of taverns and inns and bear baiting, bull baiting, and later Shakespeare's Globe Theater was built on its banks. But so there were a lot of people coming over from London to have a good time in Suffolk. So the whole Thames was very busy. And I do have a character who's a little bit of a creepy character, who I call him the Wraith of the Thames, or more affectionately, the Rat Man. he lives underneath the bridge, and he's sort of this idea. I guess I came up with him because I was thinking of the time period. There would be lots of superstitions back then, and people weren't quite ready to step into the modern era. They would probably be pulling in their superstitions and pagan beliefs from long ago. So he's kind of that creation, and he has an interest in Bianca and what's going on for personal reasons, which I won't disclose. But he does live under the bridge, and some people think he's a figment of their imagination, and he doesn't make himself known very often. And often in the series, he'll just kind of be there, but the characters are unaware that he's there.
Well,
I think you
create a wonderful atmosphere of what London was like in those days and what the people were like.
Thank you.
And there's, as I said, it there's so many connections from that era to today, mm-hmm. that we can look back and we can see where sort of the strings of connect. And I really want to tell people, I think they should read this series. They could start with the new book. It doesn't matter. You don't have to read them in order. But if you're looking for a good binge read, I think everybody should read this series, the entire series, the Bianca Goddard Mystery Series, which is by Mary Lawrence. And Mary, I think that, you know, I know there are going to be more books, because I love the fact that you are so immersed in this period and you bring these characters to life and the era and the under history of, you know, of what we sort of gloss over, the Henry VIII period. And people are seeing, you know, the like streaming videos and stuff about the this, and so I hope that people will want to learn a little bit more, and whether it's finding out what a pig's bladder full of straw means, or, you know, it's just fascinating. I think you've done such a wonderful job in bringing this these stories together, and I hope that you know, people will just first, they can also go to your website, which I think is very nice. I must say, Kensington, you are published by Kensington.
Yes, I am.
And they do such beautiful covers. I love Kensington. I love the covers they do. They are amazing, mm-hmm. and they have captured your story so beautifully.
And they really have. I just received the cover for the next book today. So I'm excited about that.
They are really an amazing group of people. The editors are fantastic. The illustrators who work for Kensington are fantastic. And they bring out really great authors like you. And I'm just so thrilled that you were able to join me today. And as I said, your books are available online, and hopefully where books are sold. I know Kensington has Barnes & Noble. Quite often they do end caps there. And your website is Mary Lawrence, what, author?
Books.
Oh, Mary Lawrence Books, okay.
There's
a zillion Mary Lawrences out there. But Mary Lawrence Books. And people should go there. They can look at, read more about you. They can see the beautiful covers. And I just want to thank you again so much for joining me today. And
thank you for inviting me.
as I said, I'm starting this weekend, I'm putting up a list of binge-worthy authors and a binge-worthy series. And yours is going to be right at the top of the list, because I think people will really get into it. And as I said, I think we all should... I don't know. We owe, I think, a lot to Anne Boleyn. She lost her head, but she gave us a different world. We would, you know, it's intriguing. Why was he
really
so
is.
Crazy about her? I mean, why? You just want to wish you could wiggle your nose, go back in time and find out what was so great about this woman that he changed the whole world, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well,
thank you so much for inviting me on. I've enjoyed it, and I really appreciate it. So.
Okay. Well, bye-bye now, Mary. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good. We're going to go to commercial. Then we're going to come back with the wonderful fighter pilot. I love fighter pilots. Okay.
Is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with the elite of the elite, the top of the top, a real top gunner. This is so exciting for me because, as all of you know, I love pilots. I go giddy around pilots, and particularly I think I would go giddy around this pilot. It is so absolutely fantastic for me to welcome to the program Paco. Now, I'm going to ask you, Paco, how you want your name pronounced, because I'm sure people have messed it up over and over.
Yeah, forever. It's pronounced just the way it's spelled. Kirichi.
Well, I knew that. I knew it was Kirichi, but because most people don't know that in Italian, CH is pronounced K, I'm sure you've had it pronounced many, many ways.
Exactly, yeah. I just say it's like Chianti. Just think of it as
exactly. That's the way to do it. And I'm sure all the women out there would just love to sit down and have Chianti with you. Paco, I must say, as I said, I get a little giddy around pilots. I have been that way ever since I met my husband. I've always loved, even as a girl, if in those days, if they would have had women fighter pilots, I would have joined the Air Force. But it is one of the things for me. I have been deeply involved for a number of years in dealing with pilots of the F-105, the THUD.
Uh-huh.
I wrote a film about an F-105, about a whole, you know, bunch of F-105 pilots, and I have a project called The Forgotten F-105 Pilots, and I've been trying to get this movie and this documentary made for years, because I love F-105 pilots are called, F-105s were called THUDs, and I love THUD pilots, and of course you are like amazing. You are a top, and when I say the top gun of the top guns, I mean, I was reading about the fact that you have 3,000 tactical hours and 400 carrier landings. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That puts you, I don't think there's, you know, in the entire world, like you are like right there at the top. You have like the top spot. It's quite amazing.
Well, thank you. I have a number of friends that have many more hours and carrier landings than I do. So,
well, don't be modest. I don't think any F-18 Hornet pilots are modest. You guys are all so, and gals now, are so amazing, which is why we're one of the elements in this book that we have gals. This book is the first of what I'm sure are going to be many books by you. The first novel, it's called Lions of the Sky, and it is terrific.
Thank you.
Well, you know, you've been, I don't know who your favorite authors were, say, sort of a mix of Clancy, and I can't think of all of the wonderful ones that you've learned by some magic that your first novel is so, so great.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Well, where do we start with this book? It's for It's so funny. One of the things it starts off with a road race, which it's one of the best road races that anybody's written in a book, because I felt like I was in that race with, and I'm wishing I was in that race with you. It was fantastic.
Well, that's great. Yeah, it's a fun scene that I really enjoyed writing, and I'm glad you enjoyed reading it.
Oh yeah. Now tell me, do you own? Is that your car? Is that the kind of car you own?
I own a sports car. Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. I do. Aside from flying fighter planes and jets, I do also love driving a sports car, and I take my car out on the track. My main character, Slammer Richardson, has a 1966 Shelby Cobra, which in the real world is worth millions of dollars. So
I was wondering. Oh well, the thing is, once they make this book into a film, you'll have millions of dollars, and then you can buy a Shelby Cobra, because
there we go.
It is a beautiful car. It is one
it
of
is.
The most.
This is my dream car. I love those cars.
Oh, it's such a gorgeous car. So we start off with Slammer, and that, of course, it's a great name. It's a great name.
Yeah.
Tell us about this character that you've developed.
Well, he's great. So, one of the things I wanted to do with this first novel in the series is sort of set the stage, obviously, for the world that that these people live in, and also show that things have come a long way, especially, in my experience, from when I started off flying in the military to where things are now. There was a lot of resistance to women being in the cockpit for combat. And Slammer is a really good guy with a pretty deep flaw, right? I mean, we all love our main characters to have a really a deep flaw, but a good character inside. And his flaw is that he mistrusts women in the cockpit. And so I wanted to give him an opportunity to change, to learn and change, and to start off in one place and end up in another. And then his foil, Keely Silvers, is the instrument of that change, right? She's going to be the one that challenges his perception and forces him to look deep inside himself and ultimately to come to believe what he believes in the end. I don't want to give it away too much, but she is that catalyst of introspection for him.
Well, when you wrote this book, of course, it's based on all of the wonderful people that you worked with, and I'm sure some of them are really thrilled to see themselves written out about in this book. But tell us about this, the whole, what you as fighter pilots, you are such an elite group of people. And of course, the F-18 Super Hornet is such an amazing plane. Tell us about it. Tell us about what it's like to fly this aircraft.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes an entire book to really describe it, but it is the most thrilling thing that I could possibly imagine doing. We take off from an aircraft carrier, which is, at the same time, it's the largest, one of the largest ships in the world, but it is by far the smallest airport in the world. And of course, it happens to be floating in the middle of the ocean. But you take off from an aircraft carrier and you weigh roughly 65,000 pounds, and you get slung from the ship in about 300 feet from 0 to 170 miles an hour. And that's just the beginning of your day. That's like waking up and going off to work. you go off and you fly your missions. Obviously, most of the stuff that we do is training. While you're up there, you're going the speed of sound. If you're practicing dogfighting, you're going at another airplane at 1,000 miles an hour of closure and passing by him by 200 feet before pulling 7 G's to try and get behind him and get a shot off. So there's incredible speed and dynamic motion and forces of gravity on the body. So it's really like an intense workout. And then when it's time to come back to the ship, you come in for the overhead brake, which is a maneuver that we use to get back onto the ship, where you're going about 600 miles an hour or 800 feet, and you fly over the ship and pull 6 G's to slow yourself down. And as you slow down, you drop your gear and flaps and keep your turn coming and descend to 600 feet. And then with about 90 degrees to go to line up to the ship, you're about 450 feet and everything's all out. Your gear, hook, and flaps are all positioned. You're now on speed, and you roll behind the ship into the groove, it's called, and you've got 15 seconds to line yourself up just perfectly and get that hook between the 2 and the 3 wire and snag a wire. And again, you're going from about 160, 150 miles an hour to zero in 150 feet. And when you hit the deck, you hit so hard that your head snaps forward and your left hand reflexively goes to full power, just in case you miss all the wires and your hook skips, and then you can bounce back up in the air again and try it again. So it's from, you know, from the word go, it's just a dynamic, exciting, sweaty, intense adrenaline adventure. And it's wonderful. And from beginning to end, it's just a really great way to live life.
Well, that's what I wanted you to explain it like that. I knew you would, because just listening, just for the listener listening to that, they're all, I think everyone was holding their breath until you landed, you know, and you create that in the book. It is quite amazing. All of your scenes, you know, you have these scenes where the pilots are taking off, where the pilots are landing, or other things are happening. But we feel, as a reader, that we are right there with you. And this is such a wonderful talent. You are just you draw us in so beautifully.
Thanks. Well, I mean, that's my primary goal, is to write a thriller where the reader feels like they're with me, right? So I didn't want to overwhelm people with hardcore technical data, or, you know, make them feel like they're observers of the action. I really, really wanted the reader to be part of the action and to feel like they're in the cockpit and in the squadron, in the ready room, involved in the banter and, you know, the parties, and just to immerse themselves in the experience.
Well, you succeeded, and on top of it, you have you brought in an international, you know, theme with a, you know, real danger, and a real thriller. So in sort of the Tom Clancy mode, it's just the whole story just comes together so nicely, and of course the characters, it really so much character driven, that you really make us care about these characters and worry about them, and sometimes, you know, it breaks our heart, you know, when things, right. You're in a dangerous business.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow. That's why I want to tell people that if they're really looking for a thrilling read, and also I know, as I said, because it's I'm sure, you know, they're going to make a film of it. And luckily, of course, we have Super Hornets that are flying. So when they make the film, it will be easy, because I've been trying to make this film about the Thud pilots, but we don't have one flying F-105, not one.
Right.
And I think it's
make it more difficult.
It's such a shame that, you know, they just destroy these planes so. I almost mindlessly. I don't understand why they have to do it. Can't cost that much to keep, you know, a few around. So I don't know. You also flew the A6s. A6s are, they still have, they're around, right?
I don't think there's any A6s flying, no. I mean, there's, you know, Davis Mothman is the boneyard in the desert where they preserve old fighter planes. So, you know, I'll bet you there's a bunch of thuds up in the desert.
No, there aren't. No, there aren't a bunch of thuds. Right. No, there aren't. Right. They just destroyed it. They went. I mean, as I was saying, they just went in and just destroyed them all. They didn't even offer them to museums, and a lot of museums would have wanted them. They just destroyed them. I don't understand it myself. I can't imagine the day when they're going to destroy the last Super Hornet. You know, these people don't care. They pay. How much does a Super Hornet cost?
60 million-ish.
60 million, give or take.
Yeah.
And so, and, you know, I don't know how many we have today flying. We have quite a few in the United States, right?
Oh, yeah. Few hundred.
Yeah, a few hundred. Okay, you know, I don't know what's next. What about the F-14? That's the one from Top Gun, the movie.
There are no F-14s flying except for in Iran, which is the plot or part of the plot of my next book.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, I hope that in your next book. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, I lived and worked in Iran for quite a few years before the shot. Yes. So, and as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, I taught English to their Air Force pilots. When I was young. I was very young, and I was in Iran, and I actually taught at the Air Force base there. I taught English. So I hope in your book that you capture a few of them and bring them back. So that we
Well, one of my characters, much like the Chinese commando character in the first book, one of my characters is an Iranian F-14 pilot. So I'll need to lean on you for a little bit of experience.
Ah, okay. Wow, that's exciting. This is I think I was like into page maybe about page 14, and I said, okay, I know this is going to be a film, and then as I'm reading and as you're building the thing is, as you are introducing the characters, and I realize so many of the characters have a lot of life left in them, although I knew some of them were going to die. You know, somebody has to die, and I wasn't sure who, but I kept saying, okay, well, he's building not characters just for this book. These are characters we will want to see again and again. So I was so happy by the end of the book, I knew, oh, okay, this is a series. This isn't one book. Are you, because I'm sure you have like a million stories that you've stored away.
I do. I have about 20 good books in me.
Okay, well, that's exciting. That's exciting. So tell us a little bit more. You know, one thing. Now, I have to go back to this racing of the cars.
Sure.
Did you really do you have any speeding tickets, or are the cops in Virginia Beach so good that they never give anybody? Because you pilots do drive fast, I know that.
We do. I'm not as young as I used to be, but when I was a new fighter pilot and living in Virginia Beach, I don't live in Virginia Beach now, but when I did, obviously back then, I had a few speeding tickets, and I used to drive those back roads, when I needed to go out and clear my head. So it's not quite a recreation. It didn't exactly happen that way, but I'm very familiar with driving fast on those lonely back roads in the Virginia and North Carolina border.
Okay. Well, I don't know if, you know, around here in Florida, the police get their Christmas bonus by giving people speeding tickets for going like going like 45 miles an hour.
Right,
so, I was thinking as I'm reading this that when I finished that, because first during this little chase here, I'm holding my breath until we get to the end of it, and then I'm thinking, then it hit me, boy, that would be one heck of a speeding ticket here.
Yeah, wow. But that wouldn't be fun in a story.
Yeah, it would. Well, you know, the thing is, of course, now you're still an active pilot.
I am, but not with the military.
Not with the military.
I'm retired out of the military now, yeah, unfortunately. But yes, I fly commercially. I'm a commercial airline pilot, 737 captain.
Okay, well, that's so wonderful. As I said, because I have been deeply involved with this F-105 project, and I know, you know, you guys are a special breed. Really, you have to be to take on this challenge of risking your life. I mean, you know, it looks very nice to see the planes up there, but every time you're up there, you are risking your life, and it is such a dangerous thing. But I don't think you guys actually think of it in that term, do you?
No, you can't. I mean, you know, it's the danger, as you mentioned, is ever present, and it the way we operate is so close to the edge of safety, and we have to, because that's, you know, when you're in combat, you can't, you know, drive in the middle of the road. You have to take chances, and inevitably things happen, either whether it's a mechanical malfunction that causes an accident or pilot error, you know, which causes a crash. Things happen and people die.
Yeah.
In the back of the book, I've got a section.
A list. It's heartbreaking. I actually read it a few times because you have also their call signs in there. One of my very first guests on Joy on Paper when I started it just over 4 years ago was Colonel Leo Thorsness, who, you know, received the Medal of Honor for a flight that he did in Vietnam in the F-105. And he was captured, you know, 11 days after the flight for that he received the Medal of Honor for, he was captured. And he spent over 1,000 days in captivity. And when I talked to him quite a few times because he supports my project. He said, you know, he was never afraid when he was in an airplane, because it was such a joy to be in the airplane and going fast.
Right.
So.
Yes.
Wow. Now.
Yeah, you don't internalize the risk, because then you wouldn't be able to do your job. And even after, you know, I've been to a number of memorial services, where obviously you pay homage to the people that have passed away, and there's a missing man formation, and it's very emotional. And then, you know, later that day, or maybe early the next morning, you're back in the saddle, you're flying, and you know, out of all the people that I knew that crashed and died, there was only one that really, it was a friend of mine and my wife's very, very close, and he passed away on our honeymoon. He had been in our wedding, and it affected me for months. You know, I would think of him as I was flying, and it was difficult. But, you know, eventually you have to take that and put it in a little box and put it in the back of your head so that it doesn't affect your work. But, yeah, it wears on you. And, you know, after doing it for 20 years, once you're done, you come to the realization that you feel very fortunate you survived. You know, there's so many people that didn't make it, so many families without fathers and in one case, mother, that you feel grateful that you made it. And it's kind of a bizarre sensation that you finally come to grips with all that loss.
Well, I think you are, you know, you are an amazing American hero for all of the missions that you flew for us. And I just close my eyes and I try to imagine how you must feel when you're in the plane coming fast toward this little spot in the ocean. It's really mind-boggling that what humans are capable of, so much wonder. Really, it's so amazing the things that we can do and can create. That we created a plane that can land on a little thing in the middle of the ocean, and you just wish sometimes we were up to the standards of this wonderful, wonderful capability, that we should all be so proud of, all of us who you know, just put our hearts into doing something special. And you are particularly amazing to me.
Well, thank you. I'm certainly no hero. I just, you know, was a young kid who got a thrill out of flying airplanes and was fortunate enough to be able to do it for 20 years.
Well, the new book is called Lions of the Sky, and your website is Lions of the Sky, right? Lionsofthesky.com. And people can go there, and the name is Paco Chiarici?
Chiarici, correct. Very good.
Okay, because people won't think of Chianti. It'd be wonderful to sit down with you over a bottle of Chianti and talk about all of your exciting, exciting adventures. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Anyone, you can look at it from so many points of view. It's a love story. It's a thriller. It's an international thriller. And it's very timely because it involves China, and we're all thinking about a lot about China. So there's so many reasons to read this book, and the best is that it's just a real exciting ride.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, well, I'm sure you're working on the new book, and as soon as it comes out, I want you to come back and join me here on Joy on Paper, because it's been a real joy to talk to you today, Paco.
Thank you, Patsy. I really appreciate it. We'll definitely do that.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Oh, he's amazing. Can you imagine landing on an aircraft carrier at hundreds of miles an hour? I don't know. It's mind-boggling. But the book, it's so good. I'm holding it up to the camera in case you're on YouTube. And it's called Lions of the Sky. And he's an amazing writer. It's, wow. If you like Tom Clancy or any thriller writer, he's right up there. And he's, I'm sure, going to have a long, long career now as a writer. And anyway, that was lots of fun. And as I said about my first guest today, Mary Lawrence, and the Bianca Goddard mystery series, again, wonderful binge reading opportunity for you to learn a lot about England and a lot about history. And I'm going to put that up on my website this weekend. And that's radio-joyonpaper.com. So you can check it out. And I have a few other series that I want people to... I'm going to concentrate a little bit on historical series, because I think it's a wonderful way to learn about history by taking one author and just going through, because, and you learn as you go through their series, as they have learned, because they add layer after layer of knowledge as they're doing the research, and you will see it. And it's really exciting, as I said, for the Bianca Goddard series by Mary Lawrence. There are so many things in that book that I did not know, and I am really, really up to date on the Tudors. So it's just exciting to find an author like that. And just remember that one of the things I always tell you is one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear the words lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into streaming video, a feature film, or perhaps a television series. And I predict definitely Lions of the Sky by Paco Kiriachi is going to be a major motion picture, because it's really, really an exciting book. But all you have to do is you have to start one page a day, and in a year you're going to have a whole novel. And then you're going to spend 2 years editing it. But nevertheless, you will have it. And make sure that you say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. I should have been in the military. I should have been a fighter pilot. I would have loved... I don't know. I would have loved it. I would have absolutely loved it. And special hello to my husband, who is also a pilot, and I love him to pieces. And thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye now.